All the Rage with John Bowd on www.tracksfm.org.
Now, we were discussing, and Paul Judge, because he thought we was on air, and we weren't. What John brought up offline was the danger of these online vigilante groups, which I'm totally in agree with the guys, John and Judge Jim, in that we don't know who these people are. They go online, they create these websites, and we don't know who they are, who they stand for, politically, morally, or any which other way. And I think it's dangerous if we do that, because if we're talking about far-right groups and what they're about and what their agenda is, who are these people doing whatever they're doing? Now, if I knew of a paedophile, or I had information on a paedophile, straight to the police, here's that information, let them deal with it. And these people, I don't know, it becomes a show, and I don't know what they're trying, what their end game is. John, take it away.
Yeah, well, on that subject, I mean, their end game is a number of things. One is notoriety or fame, and the other is never being questioned, because attacking the concept of the whole action of paedophilia, which I think I can fairly confidently say nobody really agrees with. No one thinks it's a good thing. But to use this as some kind of moral block to stand behind, it's a bit like the, you know, look at my plastic flower, I support the troops bullshit. You know, it's like, don't criticize me. All of my points and views are unimpeachable. And like you say, they normally have some kind of far-right motive behind a lot of them. But also, it's just the idea of people becoming self-appointed policemen. I cannot understand how that is ever acceptable. I really don't know how anyone can look at something like that and go, yeah, this person's all right because he's decided to, you know, say he's a pedo hunter or whatever. In fact, actually, there's at the extreme end, and I do admit this is an extremism, but the extreme end, if you look at Australia and the case of their most notorious serial killer, a man named John Bunting and some of his friends, that's pretty much what they did. You know, they were disappearing people through their own sadistic desire to murder, and say, yeah, but this guy was a perv. This guy played with kids. You know, this guy. So a lot of the people in the towns are like, oh, okay, well, that's, I go, well, there you are then. I guess that's justice. So, interestingly, to kind of bridge the conversation from the end of Jim's show to this one, I am in no agreement with any kind of vigilantism. As much as my great dislike of the police is well known to anyone who knows me, this is not how you do things. You don't just hand the law over to someone who's decided they can take it on because, you know, they haven't got a job or something. It's not acceptable. Anyway, so any feedback on that, or should we go into the next thing?
Judge, you were talking offline. I do apologise because Judge was in full flow and I had to say, well, actually, we're not on here, Judge.
It was rehearsal.
But Judge, you were talking about something in your part of the world, because there's a lot happening in your part of the world, to be honest, Judge.
Oh, well, it keeps me busy, doesn't it? What I was going to say, sorry, John.
Go for it, mate.
I think we can all agree, and I think you're right to start where you started, we can all agree that children are precious and should be protected, all children, and any form of abuse or interference with them is totally wrong. And as much as we hate the police, and there is paedophilia in the police is the legitimate protection and enforcer of the law, and they are part of the judicial process. Now, part of that judicial process is that there has been case law over many years now, where people used to be mainly tried by TV. Now now there's trial by social media, and just before we came on to air, there has been a quite high profile case, and it's only high profile because of social media. Now, heading that up, I'm not going to name any names, heading that up was a famous at the time, because he'd been sacked by the cretinous individual Mr. Stephen Yaxley Lennon. Heading that up was an individual who launched a massive hate campaign via Facebook against not just the suspect, but the suspect's defence witnesses also, and labelling all of those people as a paedophile group, quite unlawfully. Now, again, I can't go into it too much, but I have seen paperwork now that the defence, that the defence witnesses that were labelled by these individuals from the far right have now got funding to take the police for abuse of process to court because the police didn't protect adequately the defence witnesses. Now, it can be viewed online, or was, it would be able to be viewed online, that the individual that smeared and launched this hate campaign against these defence witnesses was given a police warning because he videoed it for his own gratification. And the police gave him the warning and took no further action despite the hate campaign carrying on against these people. And people were saying to me, well, what do you think? And I was thinking, well, he's messing up his own campaign, his own allegations against the suspect, because it's all been tried out on social media. I mean, it went mentally viral around the world. And I believe at the actual trial, the judge and the jury had to be changed 3 times. Now, not only does that put the case in jeopardy if the suspect has done anything wrong, but think of the expense that is cost to the taxpayer. Plus, I've heard rumours that the jury were actually nobbled and were approached between the railway station and the courthouse in the particular city of Brighton. And it was actually February last year that this all took place. Now, there's an appeal now pending because of it. Defence witnesses have now received legal aid funding to take the police to task. What that might now mean is that they get not only compensation, but they may get an injunction for the police to reopen the prosecution against the individual that's launched the hate campaign. And you might jolly well find that person is actually the perpetrator of child sex abuse themselves. Maybe. Not only that, you've got all these vigilante groups that were involved as well. One in particular in Kent, which is now being investigated for its own paedophilia offences. So work out what you will with that, please. Over to you two.
Yeah, that's one of the things I just wanted to add to everything you were saying. I mean, we'll watch this play out as it goes. But I find it really intriguing that you've got people there who have been... I think this might come under what they use as the term doxed, in which they, you know, their home, their safety has been compromised by their identity being revealed. And one of the things that little Tommy Yaxley Lennon boy likes to get into is he doesn't like it when people talk about where he lives, or he accuses people on social media and whatever of revealing the address of where, even though wherever it is that he lives, that £1 million home, is public knowledge.
Yeah.
So he and his mates will get together and actually drive to the house of, you know, some teenager who they've accused of releasing his address, and you're threatening my children and all this kind of stuff. Now, I have no idea where Mr. Lennon lives. However, if anyone is in contact with him, please feel free to tell him that I do and that I've told everybody where it is. Because, bitch, if you want to come to my house sometime, please. Come find me. Come find yourself. You're more than welcome to. Anyway, should we move on to the? Oh, sorry, Dave. Did you want to add anything? Pardon me.
No, John. It's these things sometimes take a life of their own, and it's funny how things change. You know, 2 years ago in the big debate, we were talking about maybe 3 years ago. The planes going on their way to Syria as we were on air. The Commons took a vote and we swallowed it. You know, there was no debate. You know, it's nothing like you saw yesterday. It was just we were doing it and then that's it. By a beleaguered Prime Minister who didn't, he was quite surprised when he won. And now we're having the debate on everything, anything and everything. It's amazing how things take a life on their own, John.
Yeah, and well, a couple of things before I start. Firstly, I'm less enamoured by these debates because of various flaws within the process that I see. And I will elaborate on that a little bit more probably next week, because I wanted to do a little show about much of what we've actually just discussed and where it leads to, like hate speech and unaccounted, unaccountable actions, unaccountable power, etc., etc. And this is all in line with some of the recent kind of activities around Parliament and harassing certain journalists and things like that. However, this week's subject, and interestingly enough, myself and Jim have worked completely independently of one another on this, but they serendipitously, it just seems to have connected quite nicely. So while his show was about the big issues of today, my show this week is actually going to be about a lot of the distractions, or one particular type of distraction, because this week we're going to talk about immigration scares and their consequences. We're going to do a couple of examples of what many media outlets insist on calling migration crisis, and look at a few reasons why they have taken place. One example is from the USA, and the other is going to be from Britain. In both examples, we will see how the plight of the neediest is used by authorities and extremists to try and justify their anti-human, historically ignorant attacks on foreigners for their own political gain and for their white supremacist outlook. Now, instead of a terrible influx of people clamouring to get our jobs or commit acts of terrorism, what is actually happening is people in desperate need are fleeing violence, poverty, and climate destruction that much of the world has been created in much of the world and is often the responsibility of this part of the world. A fellow named Matt Broomfield, who's an internationalist and sometimes writes for Navarra Media, has called the what's called the refugee crisis the paramount anti-fascist struggle of our times. This is a place where the far right are drawing their sharpest battle lines. The choice to accept or oppose fascism is not merely in the obvious arenas anymore. It is central to climate change, to any country with a terrible human rights abusing government, and especially if they are supported by this the country that you live in, such as this one. This is about economics and equality and who has a right to live. Simple as that. Our first example is going to be the Latin American caravan, as it's known at the moment. Oh, yeah, you know where I'm going. Okay, leading up to the US midterm elections last November, a story caught the attention of the usual slag news outlets that a caravan of people was coming from Latin America and supposedly heading towards the US border with Mexico. The increasingly far-right media, like Fox News, responded with panic, claiming that an army was on its way to invade. That is a very visible invasion by unarmed people who are walking very slowly. Amazing military tactics, I'm sure you'll agree, and nothing like what the enemy would be expecting, which they probably weren't. The usual language popped up about floods of people attacking the border. I'm fascinated how you attack a border, actually. Do you stamp on the ground? Do you punch a fence? I have no idea. Anyway, Mr. Trump did what he does by playing up the hatred that got him elected in the first place and then placing troops at said border. He even claimed that there were Middle Eastern people in the caravan, which is one of a few choice conspiracy theories that came up in this particular. If it wasn't so repulsive, I'd laugh at it more often, but there you are. It was a lovely distraction was thus provided involving people whose lives that we do not have to care about. Naturally, the full story got lost somewhere, and it hasn't been found since. Now, let's talk about the actual caravan itself. Numbers within this caravan are said to be between 4,000 to 10,000 and are largely comprised of Hondurans. There are also migrants from Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala. These countries have a few things in common, not least being royally fucked with by the US Empire for many years, and all of them are victims of colonialism. Caravans have been travelling like this for many years, but this one, with its size and associated political benefits for some, has gained more attention. Now, why are people travelling this way? There's a few reasons. One, of course, is safety in numbers, but more specifically, this is a way to move not only in a protected body, protected to a degree at least, but also to undermine the criminal, expensive and dangerous human rights, human smuggling organisations that notoriously tend to move people in situations like this. This can include the threat of death, whether through violence or dangers that can often include suffocation, such as inside containers, or drowning in the sea, or starving. This being an act of protest is another reason. I think this has been exaggerated a bit, but it's probably not entirely wrong. Some organisers have said that the journey was intended as part of an act of protest to highlight the plight of Central American migrants. And there's certainly no reason not to do that. Of course, if you know your history, especially in both America and Britain, very long walks of disenfranchised people are quite well-known acts of protest over the years. Now, one reason that Mexican people themselves often travel across the US border is due to the destruction that two American policies in particular have wrought. In economic terms, that would be via the NAFTA agreement, and socio-political ones via the drug war. The growth in legal but mostly illegal migration took place at its highest amount over about a 10-year period from 1995, which was around a year after the NAFTA agreement had come in. NAFTA actually has agreement at the end of it, so I need to stop calling it the NAFTA agreement. That's bad English. So yeah, about a year after NAFTA had come into power, up till about 2005. In fact, before the 1990s, it was a lot more common for workers to cross regularly from Mexico for seasonal work. This agreement, though, which Mr. Trump likes to talk about, damaging American workers, which no doubt it did to some degree, but nowhere near the amount of damage it did to Mexico, was instrumental in putting small farmers and agricultural workers out of business and requiring them to travel to get hold of any kind of work that they could. Mr. Tebbit was credited with claiming that we must all get on our bikes and travel for work, and the world's poorest have certainly discovered the real-world meaning of such words. The drug war has produced one commodity above all, and that is death. It has destabilized regions, produced fierce gang wars, and had a terrible effect on Mexico, which is sad for a number of reasons, but mainly because they don't even manufacture the drugs there. They're actually just used as a land point to pass them through. Famously, Bush Sr. shut down the air routes that were bringing drugs in from Panama and places like that. But unfortunately, the result of that, I'm sure not necessarily designed, but maybe it is, I don't know, was that the drugs just took to the land. So they came in that way. So they were running via production places in like Colombia all the way into America, where there's a huge market for them. And of course, they needed to be controlled on the way there. And how do you control the situation when you are moving very, very large amounts of illegal substances? Bribery and violence are the two most common ones. And as prohibition should have taught all of us, you can't actually ban substances that people want to take. Okay, I want to focus particularly on Honduras right now. One of the countries that has been most prominent in this particular caravan and their relation to America. So to read you the following from USA Today, an edition in late October, this explains it very well. Quote, most of the migrants are fleeing Honduras. They describe deteriorating conditions, economic, political, and crime-related, in their country under President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was re-elected in November in a vote many Hondurans believe was marred by fraud, but was recognized by the United States. Unquote. In 2009, there was a coup against the elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, who was wholly, and this coup was wholly backed by the U.S. and has continued to be since. The huge homicide rate in the country increased by 50% between 2008 and 2011. Femicide has skyrocketed, drug-related violence too, with gangs responsible for much of the violence. Honduran security forces have engaged in a wave of killings and other human rights crimes with utter impunity. In this time, political repression has grown too, including the murder of oppositional political candidates, LGBT activists, and peasant organizers. On the whole, institutional collapse has taken place within the usual political corruption that goes with it. And it's worth remembering all of this has happened in a capitalist country the next time someone talks shit about Venezuela. US aid has continued, however, and silence on any of these issues has been kept. When Hillary Clinton published her book Hard Choices, she admitted to her involvement as US Secretary of State in the overthrow of Zelaya, and using that power of that particular office to make sure that he would not return, conspiring with other representatives to, quote, strategize a plan to return order to Honduras, but not, it seems, return their democratically elected president. Something to think about while we have a music break, or if the two of you would like to chime in, please do.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Wow, John, where do I start?
My dulcet tones were putting you into a relaxed manner, weren't they?
Well, I'm going to give you a little bit of a 4-minute break when we come back. When we come back, a bit more more of John Bowd's All the Rage, and Judge Jim is also online as well.
All the Rage with John Bowd.
I am still.
On www.tracksfm.org.
John Bowd's All the Rage, you know, we're just talking about Talking Heads. Isn't that after film Wall Street? Isn't it? Yeah. Ooh, we're talking about pretty much everything, actually. Judge Jim's still online because technology, you know, something I've always wanted to do from 1986 is get people online, live via telephone. Some of the things we used to have to do it. It's amazing we can do it now. And we're talking about pretty much... I think it's a subject that's come up over the last 2 years ever. And some of the people that I know for years have felt that they couldn't... I think the anger is that they couldn't say anything that they wanted to say. And then over the last 2 years, they started quoting headlines. And that's great, you quote headlines. See, I'm not educated. I was terrible at school. But when I see a headline, I tend to start researching that headline. What social media has done, it gets people just to reshare that headline without any research whatsoever. None whatsoever. Absolutely none. Just put that headline up. And as I was speaking on Judge Jim's show, for example, there was a question of where did this phobia come from, Islamophobia, Zionist, Jewish, migrants, all this stuff. And then I put forward a collage over the last 2 years of the Daily Mail's headlines, and it was full of all sorts of racist stuff, let's be honest. And yeah, I don't know whether what happened in the last 2 years. It seems like we've jumped back to 1971. John, take it away.
That's a roundabout accurate, I would say. I think it's not so much we've gone back to 71 as we've just allowed a voice to come to the people who never moved on from it. And I think that, firstly, I have to say, all God bless those of us who were badly educated at school, because we shall inherit the earth, because we're the ones doing the best work now. Because they don't teach you to think in school. They teach you to be thick, as Joe Strummer once told us. The thing is, what the Daily Mail and their like are just adhering to type. And the Murdoch papers, that's what they do. The only interesting thing, I think, over the last few years, the only thing that the press in this country has done that surprised me is just where you had sort of a more sensible form of right-wing establishment reporting from the Times or the Telegraph, I think they've just become quite unhinged as well. They've just really gone off on one. The Economist has managed to keep its disconnected 90s cool to everything, whilst, publishing headlines of stuff like, Bolsonaro, yes, he's a fascist, but he's got some things right, which is the kind of thing you expect from them. But other than that, I despair. Jim, you had something to feed back on the part of tonight's subject. To remind people who are just coming on, it's the Latin American caravan that we're talking about at the moment. Go ahead, mate.
Yeah, just a bit of a news flash. The government has, in fact, survived the vote no confidence. The results are in. 325 confident to 306 no confidence of the government stands. That's all over Twitter as we speak. So there you have it. No great surprise there, really. Just goes to show, really, I'd like to say double standards, but you've probably got about 10 folds of standards there of a lot of MPs, including three Labour ones. But the Honduran 4 to 10 South Americans looking for work and a better life. Some of those I'd argue probably most of them would reach the United States. Some of them may even reach back to their former colonial master countries, such as Spain, Portugal. And I say that with experience, because I holiday quite a lot in Spain and the Canary Islands. And when you actually start getting to speak to people that you think are actually Spanish, because they speak Spanish, that are not. And what's interesting is a lot of them do come from Argentina, Honduras, Venezuela, a whole plethora of South American countries where they've come back to their former colonial master country to work. So it'll be interesting to see what sort of demographic, if there is one at all, because we are talking about fake news and Donald Trump. But wasn't it once said by a very right-wing conservative, get on your bike to look for work? That's Norman Tebbit. And now people are doing that, more or less. They're probably on their feet looking for work. And Donald Trump's saying, no, you can't have it. After, of course, the United States government and European governments, such as the UK, manipulating military coup in the South American region and the Caribbean. Just look at Guyana. There's one example in the 50s and 60s where the Conservative government back then tried to change Chedi Gagan. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, I think I've read a book on it, but I haven't researched for it tonight, so I can't be too accurate. You've got Pinochet in Chile. You've got Argentina, I mean, the beef crisis and the banking crisis there all has leads back to Spain and Britain, and so on and so forth. Look at Mexico. Mexico used to own the western seaboard of the United States. Look at all those names. Los Angeles, the Angels, that translates as. Yeah. Las Vegas, the Vegas. There's the clue. And don't start me off on the on the Red Indian argument, because what people need to see is a very good documentary on Netflix. I mean, I like the Robert Redford one, if you like the glossy version, but if you want the real grit, there's one by, I'll have to get back to you, but it's the same guy that made the Vietnam War documentary on Netflix.
Ken Burns?
That's it, Ken Burns, thank you, yeah. That gives you the true story of the Spaniards, the conquistadors, the frontier people, all of that. It doesn't even go anywhere near gunfights, or as much as I love all that, I have to be honest. And I do visit spaghetti Western film sets in Spain and the Canary Islands. But that is the true story. And the genocide that, listeners, you've got to understand, it started with the Red Indians from the Spanish, then the newly arrived Western Europeans that went on to call themselves the Americans. What they'd done was, it's just disgraceful. And then to turn around and say they're the free world. Back then, that's before we had my inspiration, like the Kennedys. Bobby Kennedy was my favourite out of the two brothers, to be honest with you. Look, I'm hogging the show. Back over to you two.
thanks, Jim, for a little input there. And also, by the way, as far as documentaries on Netflix are concerned, I happened to catch one the other night in the middle of a bout of insomnia, which was called Massacre in the Stadium, which is a quite newly released documentary about Victor Jara, the singer who was one of many people who was massacred in Chile once Margaret Thatcher's good friend, General Pinochet, took over. And also a good friend of Henry Kissinger. Of the many people who are falling in America right now, of the old guard, I cannot wait to see you go, you fucking animal. Anyway, back to the caravan. Perceptions of the caravan. The media narrative is of a rabble disorganized and making their way to the promised land of the US to do all the jobs that no one else wants, or for benefits, or for whatever reason they're going there. However, the caravan is in fact a working democratic body. Decisions are made after discussion and consensus and without hierarchy. Everybody moves when and where and is agreed to do so. I'll tell you a little more about where some of that info comes from at the end when I do recommendations. While there is a disagreement about the numbers, which is already talked about this evening, Mexican authorities have confirmed that at least 1,700 have applied for asylum or refugee status in Mexico. Nearly 200 have been offered aid after choosing to return home, and all the numbers I'm reading you now are from late October, so they've probably increased since then. We should also discuss why this has caught the attention of Americans so much. As noted in Viewpoint magazine in their very good article, The Border That Separates Us, is that what it's called? And I've got it up here, what am I talking about? Oh, The Border Crossing Us, which I've drawn a lot of from this evening. Yes, according to that particular article, 41,760 Hondurans made the trek into Mexico between January and September of 2018 alone, and yet it had nowhere near the impact on news or collective thinking as this one caravan now does. USA Today reported some of the travelling body that they spoke to did indeed intend to apply for asylum in America, which is not a crime, but it's by no means a mass movement. Certainly compared to the size of the USA, it seems rather silly to worry about numbers like this, but there you are. In the meantime, we have seen the shutting down of parts of the US government and President Trump refusing to reopen it until he gets funding approved from Congress, which includes the Democrats, that his wall along the border with Mexico, which you should remember, folks, there's already a wall there. This is about actually just making it bigger, shinier, and a bigger extension of this small man's penis, will be fully funded. By the way, the other thing that interested me, I only found this out this week, is that at the moment, this is the wall that, please remember, he was going to make Mexico pay for. There's actually a GoFundMe pledge page operating right now to try and raise money for the actual wall. So there's... that just makes me laugh, really. That does, especially that. And I had a row with someone actually who said, he is making Mexico pay for it. Okay, how's that then? He's put up tariffs. Really? Okay. So he's put up tariffs to the point that a $5 million wall can be played. Fuck me, that's some big tariffs. I wonder what they're buying from Mexico. I mean, is that how many like TVs you get from the factories there? That's a lot of tellies, baby. Okay. Moving on to the reaction, of course, more specifically the reaction of this caravan towards this caravan. There's a few reasons, of course, why you will be unsurprised to hear that I find the rejection of all the members of this caravan to be completely unacceptable. Obvious ones are the moral argument and the reality of the situation, as I think we've spelled out this evening, away from all the hysteria, but also there is a historical basis. In a Jacobin article from November of last year, Miles Culpepper writes directly about the debt the US owes to Central America after years of abuse, dictatorship, violent repression and death, not to mention neoliberalism forced upon citizens of these supposedly free countries throughout the 1980s, the 90s, the 2000s and all the way up to today. And these are parts that upheld violence, repression, murder and endless poverty. As Miles puts it, the migrant caravan is full of people fleeing a world of inequality and violence that US elites helped create. We can't turn our backs on them. I quite agree with you, mate. Of course, the reaction itself is just moral panic, as the unarmed caravan makes its way on foot and in plain sight towards the border. So I thought that was a point that was worth underlining twice. More in-depth journalism has found on the ground reaction to the refugees and migrants is actually a little less uniform than the mainstream press would have you believe. The Washington Post reported people have come out in small bands of supporters, mainly in parts of Mexico like Chiapas. Chiapas, there's a show on its own 1 week. Bear with me, listeners, I need to do a bit of research on that, but that's a region that's well worth talking about. And they've come out to provide the travellers with lots of love and lots of help, such as food, shoes and shelter. The reporter notes a lack of the appearance of George Soros or any Russians in the area, despite these being quite big talking points among the Trump-supporting Twitterati in America. To quote the article from the Washington Post, quote, "It was hard to walk a block in this town without seeing crates of free bottled water, tables packed with ham and cheese tortillas, or relief stations filled with medical supplies donated by the community to help the people on this grueling march. Residents along the route said that they are motivated by the Catholic tradition of charity, a shared familiarity with migration to the United States, and a sense of solidarity in the face of Trump's anti-migrant rhetoric." Now, I did go back to look at this article earlier on, but it's gone up behind a paywall now, so I can't tell you who wrote it. I'm sorry, but it was in the Washington Post. I thought that was worth. Also, that I included that quote because that's what solidarity looks like. So, for all of our listeners, particularly of the working class variety, just remember your history, folks. Okay, that's what we come from, not rich bastards who look like frogs taking private jets to come over here to talk about Brexit, even though he's never held a position in British politics in his life. Anyway, we'll talk about Britain in a minute. Religious and other volunteers are present all along this caravan, with UN staff and government workers, including police and immigration officials, also playing a part in helping people out. Now, this doesn't entirely reduce the threat of violence, of course, and as we've talked earlier on about vigilantes, they're just as present here as they are anywhere else. In the meantime, of course, you've got a bunch of soldier boys from the US side on the border, and really it's only a matter of time before someone gets killed. So far, there have been two high-profile deaths in all of this of children who were in US custody already. They were 8-year-old Felipe Gomez Alonso, who died on Christmas Day, in fact, and while he was in the Customs and Border Protection custody. And this was followed by the death of 7-year-old Jacqueline Cowell. The policy of family separation also made the news in the earlier part of 2018. I'm sure you'll remember it. And this involved taking children at the border and not only removing them from the care of their parents or guardians, but locking them up in separate detention centres and often in small purpose-built cages. Some organisations still estimate a large number of these children and parents or carers have not been reunited, despite what you might have heard on the news when Trump climbed down on this particular policy. We should remember, however, that this is punishment. It's punishment of migrants and refugees, and it goes back further, not least to the Obama era of detaining families together, which wasn't exactly a vast improvement, even though most liberals seem to think that it was. Condemnation from the UN does not seem to have made much difference, but then, sadly, does it ever. This is punishment, plain and simple. These people are being punished for the crime of moving. Just like the work assessment system in Britain, this is a policy of deliberate cruelty, often accompanied by the callous indifference of political leaders and the common people. Mr. Trump took his usual measured approach and claimed that he was working on removing birthright citizenship. Again, something really, really worth remembering, folks. Birthright citizenship is in the Constitution. So next time someone goes on about the Second Amendment and my right to bear arms, and this can't be changed, well, the present president is looking at scrapping birthright citizenship, which is in the same, constitutional areas. So I'll be interested to see what the libertarians think about that too, actually. Especially considering all libertarians basically become alt-right eventually. But I'd love to know what they think of that. Anyway, also the thing... Oh, sorry, I wrote this down when it came to me, actually. Also, the idea of removing... Jim's already mentioned the Native Americans this evening, so the idea of removing birthright citizenship might actually be quite beneficial to them, because they should be able to get all of their land back. And if you think we've got problems with the population of this country now, wait till they start deporting all the Americans whose families can be traced back to Scotland, Ireland, England. I've got a feeling that Poland's going to be a bit screwed too. Still, Hungary Germany. Might do well, actually. Yeah, Germany, yeah.
Germany, yeah. And Russia.
Russia, these, yeah. Actually, I think that... Also, where do Africans stand, considering they didn't exactly choose to go there? Hungary will be doing interestingly, because they've just whacked up people's hours to 100 hours a week, because by stopping migration, they haven't got enough staff to work their shitty jobs. So there you go. Anyway, so I just wanted to end this particular section on a quote. Margaret Hang, the executive director of Amnesty International USA, said the Trump administration's policy of cruelty towards migrants and asylum seekers at the border must cease immediately before any more children are harmed. Amen to that, mate. Right, I was going to move on to the UK, but do you want a break? Chime in quickly, fellas. Please feel free.
Go on. Dave, after you... Oh, okay. I was going to say, you're quite right. I mean, if you look at the West by Ken Burns on Netflix, that goes in depth into the Indian reservations and how they were cleansed, if you like, of all their beliefs and their religion and their way of life. And what they done was as they used a tactic. The Union soldiers used, or the Union government, or the United States government at the time, used a tactic that they used against the Confederates, and that was they hit what hurt the most. So what they done, they sent in guerrillas behind the lines to raid farms and burn crops. And what they done with the Red Indians, when they sent in the U.S. cavalry, the 7th Cavalry were pushed west to go and guard the gold that was found in the Black Hills. What they done was to eradicate the Indians that were making a resistance war against them. Sitting Bull was one of them. Look him up. He was a formidable man, that bloke was.
Indeed.
He had a mentor. I can't remember what he was called now, but anyway, what they done was they wiped out the buffalo, because the Indians survived on the buffalo. The buffalo would feed them, house them, and clothe them. Everything you kill a buffalo, the big shaggy they were known as, you get a coat, a blanket, your teepee, and your meat. And that's it. That's everything. So the Red Indian were a nomadic tribe. They didn't have parameters of land. They had the whole land. So they would follow there's millions of buffaloes in the Victorian era that were around for them to live off, that the US government at the time picked off, and that's what happened. And the biggest idiot of the US Army was what was his name now? Bloody oh, I looked him up. He had the big blonde locks. What was his name now? Not Buffalo Bill. Not Bill Cody. thank you, David. And General Custer was the biggest Wally, for want of better words, in the US Army. Because what it was, he was promised the position of US President for his action against the Confederates and the Red Indians. And he was tasked with going after Crying Bull? I just mentioned his word a minute ago, but Sitting Bull, that's it. He was tasked going after Sitting Bull. because Sitting Bull was running amok all over the United States in their territories, as the Indian Territory, because they had a borderless country. They ran it from what we regard from kind of the top of Mexico all the way into Canada, because they would move with the seasons and move with the buffalo. So he was tasked with going to guard the Black Hills, and that idiot took his men into a charge without doing a recce on what he was facing and got totally wiped out, because what he wanted to do was pull off the biggest publicity stunt so he'd come back the big hero. But what he, as well as managing to wipe out his own men, he became a national hero as a martyr, and of course they raised a bigger army and went after the Red Indian. But it took them decades to beat them. They couldn't beat them. If the Red Indians were supplied with the same technology as the US Army, because the US Army at the time were importing European firearms like Martini Henrys, and they set up Colts and Schofields and whatnot, but they didn't quite master they never have done the US Army tactics, the Red Indians would have won. They would have beaten them. I'm confident of that.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of wars America's lost, isn't it? They got involved with all the best gear and no idea.
Yeah,
how that works.
In terms of immigration, John, you're right. I mean, if you look at South America, a lot of people do go back to Spain, Portugal, and the Canaries. I mean, the amount of people I talk to, and say, "Oh, where are you from?" And I'm like, "Wow, you wouldn't know, because they're talking the same language as me." So yeah, I mean, imagine that. Your birthright, you get chucked out. Yeah, that'd be so interesting.
Yes.
I'm sounding cruel to our US listeners, but it'd be interesting to see, wouldn't it, that who is the real immigrants there? Because there'll be a lot of former countries filled right up again. But you know, and same with the Caribbean as well.
Well, to be fair, Jim, I think most of US listeners to this show as I believe the term the young people use is woke. So I'm sure they're not going to. This couple of limeys sound enough about their country's history. I think they'll be fine with that, don't worry.
Anyway. If you look at Caribbean history with the slaves, what the British and Dutch used to do is the Dutch that invented the idea of slavery, and the British took it to another level. And they used to capture tribes of people and mix the tribes up, chain them up, and then take them to the plantations. They couldn't talk to each other, so they couldn't communicate, they couldn't organise, and they couldn't revolt. But anyway, sorry, that's enough of my ranting.
No, I appreciate your input, mate. Sorry, Dave, go on.
We're going to go to a break now, but it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I thought, looking at Grenfell, that, and someone spoke to me about social cleansing, and I didn't know anything about it. And Jim and John are talking about stuff that's about everything hundreds of years ago. It's just clicked to me. Anyway, it's amazing trade unionism, because they're two very good reps, and God, they know so much other stuff. Blimey. John's back after this.
John Bouts, all the rage, all the on Tracks FM, Tracks FM, Tracks FM, Tracks FM.
Brothers and sisters, I don't know what this world is coming to.
Yes, the rhythm's a rebel. Without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard rhyme, where you never been, I'm in. You want styling? You know it's time again. D, the enemy, telling you to hear it. They praise the music, it's time to play the lyrics. Some say no to the album, the show. Bum rush the sound, I made a year ago. I guess you know, you guess I'm just a radical. Not on sabbatical, yes, to make it critical. The only part of your body should be party at two. Pair the power on the hour from the rebel to you.
Hey, yo, Chuck, man, I don't understand this, man. Yo, you got this money out, man, you're losing them.
Radio, suckers never play me. All the mix, they just okay me now. Knowing and grown, when they're clocking my zone, there's no sneaking and taking everything that the brother owns.
Hard.
My calling card, recorded and ordered. Supporter of Chess and Mart, loud and proud. Kicking live, next poet supreme. Loop for truth, bazooka, the scheme.
Flavor,
a rebel in his own mind. Supporter of my rhyme, designed to scatter a line of suckers who claim I do crime.
disable the power of my label. Death Jam tells you who I am. The enemy's public, they really give a damn. Strong Island, where I got a violin. That's the reason they're claiming that I'm violent. Never silent, no dope, getting dumb, nope. Claiming where we get our rhythm from. Number one, we hit you and we give you some. No gun, it's still never on the run. You wanna be an S1, grip I tell you when. And then you come again, you know what time it is. MP's the president, pulling out my ray gun. Zap the next one, I could be your shogun. A minute, soft and smooth, I ain't with it.
Hardcore,
raw bone like a razor. I'm like a laser, I just won't phase ya. Old enough to raise ya, so this will phase ya. Get it right, boy, maybe I will praise ya. Playing a role I got soul to. Force my opinion with volume.
Smooth,
not what I am.
Rock,
cause I'm a man. No matter what the name, we're all the same. Pieces in one big chess game.
Yeah.
Take a shower, boy. P.E. our crew, our crew, not singular. We wear black Wranglers, we're rap stranglers. You can't angle us, I know you're listening. I caught you pissing your pants. You're scared of pissing us, the crowd is missing us. We're on a mission, y'all.
Yo, Chuck, yo, yeah, man. Yo, you got them running scared, man.
Terminator X.
Some more, son, you wanna get some 1987 and Public Enemy and Rebel Without a Pause. You're listening to John Barrett's All the Rage with special guest Judge Jim. He's in the house. I was gonna say just after me is someone else, but they're not, so it's okay, we can go over. Hope you're enjoying yourself. This is quite revealing. John, take it away.
Thanks, mate. Yes, some songs never get old, do they? That is a classic. Okay, so removing ourselves from America now, we're going to come a little bit closer to home and talk about the UK. In Britain, December just passed, we saw 114 people attempt to cross the channel from France, most of whom were Iranian. Now, in the same, there's a few more figures for you. 6,912 attempted to cross the Mediterranean in the same month. At the height of what has become known as the refugee crisis of a couple of years back, 200,000 attempted to cross the Mediterranean in 1 month. So again, that is 144 people coming to a country of around 66 million. On the 2nd of January, the government declared people should not travel this way while claiming to boost policing in the area. Home Secretary Sajid Javid did the usual of questioning if asylum seekers were for real and asking why they did not claim asylum in the first safe country they landed in. That, in this case, was France. Well, Channel 4 News provided an answer to that question within the first 10 minutes of their show that evening by talking to some of the actual people claiming asylum and finding out that many of them, in this case of the Iranians, had family connections in this country, but also found that the French asylum system, even I get mixed up with these things sometimes, is rather purposefully long-winded and problematic and leaves people floating. So, and of course, when you are floating, you get pretty hungry. And anyway, all of that to one side, who is Javid or anyone to question without any proof if anyone's asylum claim is for real? So one of these things that really, really annoys me is people, we talked about this with the media and stuff earlier, you spread this idea that someone's asylum claim might not be for real. No proof that it isn't for real. Nothing to say about the numbers for those whose asylum claims do prove to be false versus those who are not false. And it often, again, comes from people whose... people say, you know, we talked about this before, like some of their motivations are suspect. I don't think their motivations are suspect at all. I know exactly what their motivations are. They don't like foreigners. They don't like people who are a different colour. and they have some fantasy idea of Britain as a white supremacist enclave, which it isn't and never was and never should be. So that's what their motivation is. Fuck those people. All of this is basically refugee hatred and nothing more. And no one should be in office when they indulge in dangerous and indecent rhetoric like this. There was an amazing piece of footage on the BBC on the 7th of January of three or four Iranian asylum seekers being brought up the road by immigration officials or police or whoever the fuck they were, and they'd found them on the beach, and they were exhausted. They were wearing those, listeners might be familiar with these, sometimes when you have had a shock or when you finished a marathon, they give you these big silver warming blankets to put over you. So they were freezing because they come out of the water. They had these blankets over them. They were limping, they were hobbling, and being led up the street by some makeshift, you know, pretend hard man. Now, one lady who was living in one of the swanky houses in this area that all looked exactly the same was looking over her fence at these poor knackered men hobbling towards a van. When the BBC asked her, you know, how did you feel about what she was looking at, she claimed that she thought it was, quote, frightening. Seeing these people was frightening. Imagine, if you can, a life that's so easy, so devoid of trouble and real fear, that the sight of a hobbling foreigner inspires fear in you. We cannot ignore the politics here, of course, as Britain heads into the sea with the absolute clusterfuck of Brexit, which has got substantially worse since I actually wrote that sentence last week. We need a distraction, as ever. We always need distractions, don't we, kids? It's one that reminds racists and xenophobes of why they voted to leave in the first place, and that distraction is all the better. Then there is Mr. Javid himself, often spoken of, probably by himself as much as anyone, as a potential future leader of the Conservative Party, and he's no doubt making a play for it here to show what he is willing to do, and God knows what else he's willing to do. One particular fear I have is where people like him stand when Mr. Trump tries to launch a war against Iran. But let's hope I'm wrong about that. Considering the people he's got in his cabinet, though, I doubt it, but there you are. Mr. Javid is rather a crafty player too, because he's often trying to hit spots on many sides. He claims, for instance, that he would sort out the Windrush scandal with empathy, because after all, he is a son of an immigrant, and it could have been him. Then he sends warships to patrol the seas to see if there's a couple of dinghies full of unarmed, desperate people coming towards British shores, just like the far right have called for to happen many times. And it reminds me also of his comedian-like religious identity too. Some of you might remembered the times in the past where he's one time claimed to really live in a Christian household, and then he's claimed that he's a Muslim, depending on the issue that he's talking about. Quite frankly, to sum it up on Mr. Say Javid, I think he's a rather a nasty piece of work, and he needs to be watched. And that's even without mentioning his woeful time when he was culture secretary, in which, outside of praising ticket touts, I'm not quite sure what else he did, and his times in prosing certain issues on us trade unionists. But, yeah, we'll talk about him some other time. The Conservative Party, like their political movement, has great investment in foreign bashing, and they are also known for these assessments of public attitudes that sympathy for refugees and asylum seekers is actually higher than for those deemed economic migrants. So the need for demonisation is quite high. And, I mean, I hate these people, actually, but they're not stupid. They can look at polls and policies like the rest of us. They can see what's going on. They can see what people really think. Yeah. What better time then for a moral panic about invasion by desperate people in a dinghy storming our shores? Britain is a very stingy place these days, very stingy for refugees, and always has been, and it's particularly for those that are less photogenic. They often, let's be honest, the trend is that for European people are more accepted than African ones, for instance, and their needs tend to, in fact their lives tend to actually register a little bit less. We do occasionally have a few moments, a day or so, of hand-wringing and head-bowing when we see little children washing up on a beach. But then a few days later, we try and demonise them by saying, well, you know, his dad was a bit dodgy and he shouldn't have put him in the boat, and et cetera, et cetera. And we will forget about it pretty quickly, I'm sad to say. A few years ago, we saw the mainstreaming of these kind of opinions that migrants and asylum seekers should be killed, when little Katie Hopkins suggested, as former BNP leader Nick Griffin had done previously, that warships should be sent into the sea and machine guns should be used on those boats. This was in her page in The Sun, if anyone remembers that. They gave her a column. And I remember at the time there was calls for, The Sun should fire Katie Hopkins. And actually, I didn't sign up to those. And the main reason being because Katie Hopkins does what Katie Hopkins does. That's why she was hired by both that awful publication and the Daily Mail. The issue is not getting her kicked out of there. The issue is getting it shut down, because that's the ideology that they have put forward and will always put forward. The names and faces might change, but who cares? So, you know, yeah, if you want to, you know, the Daily Mail and that. The Daily Mail, of course, for our listeners who don't know, got rid of Katie Hopkins after she cost them an absolute shitload of money, because she can't keep her mouth shut about things that are legally provable to be lies. And so they got sued twice for quite hefty amounts in the same year. So she's now running around the place being even more far right. And is she on the same stage as David Irving yet? I don't know. She probably will be soon enough. And various other attention grabbing stuff. One twisted lady. Anyway, in reality, though, however, after all of this stuff about warships and everything else, I'm afraid to say that the simple, brutal reality is actually simpler for most of Europe to just let them drown. Interestingly, too, that we have seen panic over Islamic terrorists trying to get into Parliament and talk of heightened security all around the area. And now it's actually perfectly all right for far-right white boys kicking off in the same place, attacking journalists like Owen Jones, being very unpleasant to Anna Soubry, etc., etc. However, as I said earlier on, we will talk about that more next week. I believe a radicalised policy is in order to deal with all of this kind of thing. And also, I just want to make a quick reference, by the way. So some people might be wondering about a bit of British history in regards taking in refugees and those in need. Let's just very quickly say something about the Kinder Transport. This was an organised rescue from Germany around 9 months before the outbreak of World War II, and Britain took in 10,000 predominantly Jewish children from all over Eastern Europe. They were often unaccompanied and also orphaned, or sadly they later became so, because they were also often the only members of their family who survived the Holocaust. While there is no doubt a magnificent moment in British history, and one that inspires much of the misplaced admiration people often have for British values, it must also be admitted that it has been a little bit over-glossed, as most modern British history tends to be. For starters, a country could have taken in more, and we must not forget the rejection that initially met these children, nor from where the rejection came from, the very same people and newspapers as today, in many cases, who had already, by this point, turned on refugee kids from Spain and campaigned to not let any more refugees in. So that was that thing. Okay, now we come to the conclusion. So let's kind of tidy all of this up, shall we? Something that links all panics and wider hatred about immigrants ties into the wider issues of hatred of poor people and immigrants in general. More specifically, the hostility towards people in this position. And it's all about worth. Within our culture, or even the hallowed Western culture, it's completely informed by extreme prejudice, mostly influenced by colonial attitudes and self-righteous perceptions. We see a lot of this kind of thing. So immigrants and the poor are hated within our social system because of perceptions of their lesser worth. They deserve to suffer, no matter what the consequences, and we need to see some people as less than us, no matter how low we are in life's pecking order, and their suffering is vital for our personal and collective sense of worth. It is ideas like this that I wish to have a culture war with and bring an absolute death to. That's the ideas, not people. We see this in government. The much hated universal credit is designed to make life harder for people receiving this benefit. It is designed and built by people who have shown that they do not care if their policies kill the people who are receiving them. Now, I just want to do a bit of time travel for the next paragraph. It goes like this. No doubt the big issue for the far right and immigration haters in 2019 will be boats in the English Channel. The press will happily oblige, as they always do, with lots of scare stories about invasion and the seas not being safe. And this will be tied into the EU in some way, I have no doubt. The paragraph there that I just read you was written by me on Boxing Day, 2018, sometime in the afternoon. By the next day, it had become obsolete, because everything I said in that paragraph had come into reality, because the media went into hyperdrive. A tiny amount of migrant boats crossing the channel. The Home Secretary was recalled from his grand holiday. The usual papers wrote about an invasion of unarmed, desperate people. And my prediction had come true so early that I hadn't even finished my Christmas leftovers. The wider issue is the need for migration growing as the world becomes more unstable. That's what we should really be looking at. Poorer parts of the world are not only suffering from years of economic and social upheaval caused by neoliberal experimentation and neo-imperialism, but now climate change is making many places uninhabitable, and this is where things start to get really nasty. Because what we are seeing now is choices needing to be made that directly concern humanity. Who is given refuge and who is refused? How power is distributed? As the Viewpoint magazine article that I quoted from earlier on also says, quote, an internationalist position, a central feature of any strategy that hopes to rout barbarism's worldwide advance, is now utterly necessary. This is going to keep happening too, from people fleeing climate disaster that makes their homelands uninhabitable to people fleeing persecution, which will no doubt be happening for LGBT and left-wing people in Brazil any day now. In Britain, there is no migrant crisis. In America, there is no danger from this caravan. In both cases, this is a politically manufactured panic designed to scapegoat those who are not in a strong enough position to fight back. Political and personal cowardice at its absolute worst. These are the spoils of empire. They are now exposed like an ugly wound that cannot be passed off as normal any longer. If you live in the US, the best things you can do are proactive, such as welcome migrants and refugees in any way that you can, including those described in the show. Also make your political representatives aware that you do not support the cruelty of this policy or anything to do with this stupid fucking wall. And then when you've done that, abolish ICE. All of the anti-immigrant stuff doesn't even work anyway. If you really want to stop the need for people to leave their homes and their land, you stop supporting and promoting war, you end the arms trade, and embrace the destruction of capitalism, because this is what creates the need for people to get up and leave. Add to that environmental catastrophe, and we see it as the need to overcome capitalism and all of its failures is actually the bare, unavoidable, stark truth here. As Greg Gradin notes in a Jacobin article, the United States is dependent on the labour of immigrants, and this is exactly what confirms their rights. However, while we follow the argument of scarce resources and who deserves them and who doesn't, the danger is resentment of migrants becomes carelessness about their lives and their death. And I would argue that, unfortunately, I think we're already there. More people in Britain see immigration as a positive, we are told, and we need to embrace this, because simply being okay with immigrants or LGBT people or just not being racist in the first place is not good enough. We must be proactive in praising and defending these things. We must talk about why we love immigration, all the great things it's brought to us, not least edible food, for crying out loud. Blimey, I remember this country and we didn't have street food from Malaysia or Mexico, and it was awful. Although I've never been much of a social media type, I think we need to get better on those channels and spread the word. But most of all, we need to stand up to the far right in the streets and the media and anywhere else that we find these people. And there must be, sorry, libs, centrists, but there has to be absolutely no compromise with these scumbags. If you want to rip this show, by the way, if you think there's anything useful worth pushing around the place, and I haven't actually okayed this with Dave yet, but if you want to rip this show and pass it around the place, be my guest. Put it wherever you like, or any of the rest of my shows. I hope you're right there, Dave. Anyway, just in closing, we need to win this fight once and for all. Go for it, Dave.
Thank you very much, John. A massive thank you to John Bowes, All the Rage, and Judge Jim's Big Debate. They're both jointly on there, and it's lots happening in the UK. I'll just make a small note on what I've just heard over the last 2 hours. You're talking about two trade union reps. Imagine what we've learnt today, and these boys represent people in the workplace for free, and they self-educate as well. With them, I think the future looks good. Without them, I despair. Thank you very much, John. Coming up, it's me, isn't it? And I'm going to play this one for John. Louise Distress and Street Revolution.
All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.